Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith located in Sacramento, California.
We hope our podcast will help those who listen to grow in faith.
The podcasts currently feature the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
We hope you find them inspiring. Passage this morning is out of the book of John in the gospel. It's going to be presented to us in a little bit different way, and I'm going to invite our children to stay and watch, and then when the movie's over, then you guys can go. I want to tell you about the woman who is speaking, because this passage is a little easier to understand that way. She's going to tell us the story of a woman we know as a Samaritan woman, and she meets Jesus at a place called Jacob's Well. Jacob's Well, if you can sort of think about it this way, but sort of not, but think about, you know, like the corner Pete's, or the corner Starbucks, or Tupelo, or Old Soul, whatever your neighborhood is, it's the place people go at least once a day. Now, in those days, you had to go to the well to get your water every day, and then you would take it home. So you'd have enough water to drink and prepare your food. So you can imagine, if you're going to do that, are you going to do it at night? No, you're going to go early in the morning when it's cool, because it's a long hike and it can be really heavy. For some reason, we're not exactly sure, this woman comes to the well at noon, the heat of the day, to get her water. And she's from a place called Samaria. And the people that Jesus hung out with and the people that she hung out with did not get along. So much so that they really were not allowed to speak to each other. So these people come together, Jesus and the woman from Samaria, and this is what happens.
Importance. I am a woman of no reputation save that which is bad. You whisper as I pass by and cast judgmental glances, though you don't really take the time to look at me or even get to know me. For to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known, and otherwise what's the point in doing either one of them in the first place? I want to be known. I want someone to look at my face and not just see two eyes, a nose, a mouth, and two ears, but to see all that I am and could be, all my hopes, loves, and fears. That's too much to hope for, to wish for, or pray for, so I don't, not anymore. Now I keep to myself, and by that I mean the pain that keeps me in my own private jail, the pain that's brought me here at midday to this well. To ask for a drink is no big request, but to ask it of me, a woman unclean, ashamed, used, and abused, an outcast, a failure, a disappointment, a sinner, no drink passing from these hands to your lips could ever be refreshing, only condemning, as I'm sure you condemn me now, but you don't. You're a man of no distinction, though of the utmost importance, a man with little reputation, at least so far. You whisper and tell me to my face what all those glances have been about, and you take the time to really look at me, but don't need to get to know me, for to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known. And you know me. You actually know me, all of me and everything about me, every thought inside and hair on top of my head, every hurt stored up, every hope, every dread, my past and my future, all I am and could be. You tell me everything. You tell me about me. And that which is spoken by another would bring hate and condemnation. Coming from you brings love, grace, mercy, hope, and salvation. I've heard of one to come who would save a wretch like me, and here in my presence you say I am he. To be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known. And I just met you, but I love you. I don't know you, but I want to get to. Let me run back to town. This is way too much for just me. There are others, brothers, sisters, lovers, haters, the good and the bad, sinners and saints, who should hear what you've told me, who should see what you've shown me, who should taste what you gave me, who should feel how you forgave me. For to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known. And they all need this too. We all do need it for our own.
God, may your spirit move freely in our hearts, in our minds, in our souls, in our whole bodies, as we reflect together on your love, on your grace, on the way that you meet us, the way that you know us, and the way that you love us. Open us this time to your grace that flows so freely. Amen. We spent some time, we went back to the Midwest, and until a little while ago, I was the kind of traveler, I'll call it a quiet traveler. I still think there are two kinds of travelers. There are kinds of travelers like me who sit quietly in the airplane and don't bother the people around them. And then there are those other people, and my anxiety level goes up when everyone is getting onto the plane. I might be alone in this, but maybe not. Susanna's smiling. There's this moment where the person sits down next to you, and I'm trying to decide, are they going to be a quiet person, or are they going to be a talker, right? Oh, no, not the talker. And I move in the space wondering about where am I going to be seated and who's going to be next to me. Well, everything shifted for us a little while ago. We have a 17-month-old daughter, and she doesn't really fit either category, and anymore she doesn't let me fit either category. We walk onto the plane, and Eleanor walks on with her little legs moving, and she puts her hand up to everyone that she sees. She waves, and then she gets this huge smile, one ear to the other, and she's smiling at them. And some people notice and some folks don't, but it breaks down all of these barriers. Folks that I never would have even noticed, I'm now looking at them because my daughter can't stop waving at them. And it just makes me look up. And so the other day we met a young girl, a 2-year-old named Lily, and we met her parents. He works for the state of Iowa, and then we met after that, we met another family that was seated across from us because Eleanor learned to play peekaboo with their 8-month-old daughter as we flew from Denver to Sacramento. And then we met another woman who was seated next to us who was a pilot, and she was flying back to Sacramento because she was going to fly out tomorrow on another airline as the pilot. So all these folks that I would have walked right past, I started to get to know just a little bit of their stories because Eleanor cannot stop herself. She has to befriend everyone that's around us, and she's pushing my boundaries. She's pushing that quiet place that I like to sit, that I won't be seen and I won't look at others, so I can just get to the place that I am going. She helps me to slow down in that sense, to actually connect with the folks that I would have never met. I would have walked right past. In today's reading that we experience through spoken word in front of us, it's a story of Jesus making his way back, leaving Judea on his way back to Galilee. And it's a story of an encounter like that. It's a story of Jesus making a choice, first of all. He makes a choice to go through Samaria. There's nothing in the text that would tell us why Jesus would go through Samaria. In fact, it's of note to say that Jesus went through Samaria. It's the last place that a Jewish person would want to walk, because these are folks that we do not want to be around. So in John 4, verse 4, when it says that Jesus went through Samaria, that's significant. There's not just one road. He could have made the way around like everyone else did. And many of us have heard the story of the Good Samaritan, right? Where Jesus tells the parable about there's this person who is in deep need, and everyone walks right past. Everyone except the last person that you would imagine offering help, the Samaritan. And mostly, I think we could call this the other story of the Samaritan. But actually, in the text and in the ways that it's been interpreted over time, the Samaritan part of this woman's identity gets lost. And really, the only thing that people tend to focus on is that it's a woman at the well. Right? That's the heading, the woman at the well. That's what we hear about. That's what we've come to know, because so many folks have interpreted her as a shady lady. Not the shady lady that some of us play at, but as a shady lady. See, David Lose writes about it this way. She's not a prostitute. She doesn't have a shady past. Yet when millions of Christians listen to her story this coming Sunday in church, they're likely to hear their preachers describe her in just those terms. He continues, she's a Samaritan woman who Jesus encounters by a well, and a place where women and men in this culture, generally it's not safe for them to have social interactions in such a public place. So she's doubly surprised when Jesus asks her for a drink. And she makes a remark to that effect, and he offers her living water. And it doesn't make sense to her. See, she's been doing this every day, going back to the well. And so what she's thinking about is literal water. How am I going to have water for my family? And what Jesus starts to talk to her about is living water. He's talking metaphorical, and the conversation continues, and she's confused, but she keeps pushing on. And then Jesus asks the question, go and find your husband and then come back and return. And she says that she has no husband. And he says, you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. And so that's the phrase. That's the phrase that everyone grabs hold of. They grab hold of it, and then they make this whole story up about her. Because she's had five husbands, and the one that she's with right now is not her husband. John Piper, who's a very conservative preacher and pastor in Minnesota, he describes her this way in a sermon that he wrote. She is a worldly, sensually minded, unspiritual harlot from Samaria. Whoa. And at another point, he actually calls her a whore. Harsh, yeah, harsh. And actually not biblically accurate to the other side of it as well. There's a harshness piece to it, and then there's also a way that we read our stories into these stories. And there's nothing in this passage that would tell us this. See, Jesus at no point invites her to repent. He never brings up sin, not in the slightest. Actually, you could think about this woman as being widowed multiple times. I mean, it's tragic to think about that, but that's not implausible. You could think about it that she was left or divorced five times. And in those days, those are the same thing. When a man left, that was the end. You could also think about this man that she's living with as being a custom that we don't hold on to today, but she's actually in a type of marriage with potentially her husband's brother who passed away. And that wouldn't technically be marriage, but it was thought of as such. But we don't take any of those interpretations. We don't allow her to be the woman like maybe we heard in the spoken word today. We like the one that makes her as bad as she could possibly be. And then I think we oftentimes read in that she's somehow repented in some way and turned away from that, but we don't find that either. Unlike the Nicodemus story that we heard last week, we heard the story of Jesus saying, you must be born from above or born anew. All we get in this story is conversation. All we get is a conversation that opens someone up, opens this woman's life up to seeing Jesus in a new way. And it's not just preachers, though. It's not just preachers who tend to see something as something other than what it is. We all do that in our lives, right? We see something for something other than what's there. I think about it in this way. There's a tendency, we were back in the Midwest and Sarah was connecting with relatives that she hadn't seen in some time. And so you meet that person that you haven't seen in years, and your tendency, my tendency, is to think of them as the same person they were. We don't allow them to change, to be the person that they've become. We hold that memory of who they were, or in relationships often. We don't see our partners for who they are. We see them for what we need them to be. And then we project so much onto that. I hear it from young people a lot. I hear it from young people about the church. We don't have a place where we can have a voice. So we create alternative structures to find a voice. See, we feel like the church can't see us for who we are, so we create something on the side. And I hear it from older people as well. The church is leaving me behind. It doesn't see me for the gifts that I have. It doesn't allow me to be me. I hear it in a story of a friend who came here from New York City. And in New York, he could walk down the street as an African-American man, and he could be himself and not fear who was walking next to him. And he walks at moments in Sacramento, and he can feel the way people judge for his long dreadlocks. It's not every relationship that goes in that way. See, there are moments where we're actually seen, where we're actually known, and where we're loved. One of the strongest examples for me is a mentor of mine from college, and his name is Dan Spencer. Dan is a professor now. He is a United Church of Christ pastor as well. And he was an openly gay man who was ordained in the United Church of Christ in Iowa, the first openly gay person to be ordained in Iowa. And Dan tells the story of trying to make his way faithfully as gay and as Christian, and coming up over and over with folks that tried to close those two options down for him. You have to choose one or the other. So Dan ran away in so many different ways from his own identity and tried to make sense of who he could be and how he could be faithful and to repress much of who God had made him to be. And then Dan found his way to a Lutheran retreat village in Washington, and there he met a pastor, and he went thinking that he was confessing to this pastor, confessing his longing to be with other men to this pastor, and the pastor looked at him and said, "Is there anything in those individual relationships that you need to repent from and put it back on him? Is there anything about those relationships that isn't loving or just or holy?" And from that affirmation, Dan began a long journey of making his way as faithful to Jesus and as gay. My own story is a little bit different. I walked in to seminary in New York City, and I was doing my own version of running away. See, I'd been reading about liberation theologies, folks that were pretty certain that the way dominant white culture in America was doing things was harming and hurting and destroying people of color, the environment, the world around us. And so I got to seminary pretty angry at myself, deconstructing all those pieces, the whiteness, the heterosexuality, the maleness, all of those pieces. And I encountered some young adults, teenagers, at a place called Youth Ministries for Peace and Justice. And we started a long conversation where these young people helped me to see that God's love for the world, it was easy for me to say, but God's love for the world could be for me too. And so it was young 15, 16, 17-year-old Puerto Rican and Dominican kids that listened to me and learned to love me in a way that I could allow God to love me as well. Maybe you have a story like that, a story where someone saw you for who you were, where they met you where you were, they knew you, and they loved you. It's a holy time. It's a holy place. It's a holy conversation, a holy relationship. In our weekly kitchen table gatherings, we gather as small groups here at the table at Central. We gather weekly in an old Methodist framework of asking each other, "How is it with your soul?" We watch over each other in love, and we start with that question very intentionally. And then some of us move to prayer, and some of us move to Bible study, and some of us move into worship. But we gather around that question because we seek to know each other, to share our stories, to be seen, and in that process, to be known and to be loved. It's that order that's significant, because we can so often, just like John Piper brings his readings to those stories, we bring our real lives to these stories as well. And so we begin there. We begin with who we are and try to listen for the holy in one another. And I think that's something like what happens in John's gospel. It's of note to me that this is the longest recorded conversation that Jesus has with anyone in the whole Bible. And it's this Samaritan woman. And we hear the story just a moment more. I want to reflect on it. See, it's extraordinary that it took place at all. He's Jewish and she's Samaritan. I'm white. These young people are Puerto Rican. We're not supposed to walk in the same circles. He is this transient citizen who's walking through, and she's from that place. They're not supposed to connect. He's male and she's female. They're not supposed to know each other. They're not supposed to see each other. But that's exactly what happens. See, in this conversation, Jesus requests a drink of water, and it prompts her to defend her whole community against Jesus. She quickly moves into a place of argument, I think you could say. She's bold talking to this man. And she says, "My people worship here at this mountain, and the Jews don't believe that that's where God is. You worship in Jerusalem." It's of note to me that Jesus doesn't debate her. He doesn't strike back with a but or an and. He just declares that worshiping God is beyond geography. You might say beyond race, beyond culture, beyond place, beyond liturgy. And in this process, she moves from seeing him as a prophet of another community to saying that all of the categories I have for him do not fit. He must be the one, the Messiah. And so then she becomes a witness. And I think some of you might like the kind of witness that she becomes, because it's not the kind of witness that some of us have heard about in Christianity, the witness that comes with a club. No, this is not a witness who comes with a bullhorn. Listen to some of the ways that she comes as a witness. She first goes back to her people, and she says that a man who told me all that I ever did, that's all she says about him. It's not exactly laying out doctrine for him, saying this is what you must believe. She just goes back to her people and says, "This man told me all that I'd ever done." And folks listened to her. She wasn't really thorough, you could say. I don't even know that she was convinced. She goes back with this question, "Can this be the Christ?" Literally in the Greek, I think it's better translated, "This cannot be the Christ, can it?" That might be a kind of witness that some of us could feel a little bit more comfortable with. Even so, her witness is enough because it's invitational. It's relational. She doesn't come with judgment. She comes with an honest experience of having been seen and known and loved by this man and wanting to share that with others. She couldn't keep it to herself. So she goes back to folks that she knows, and she invites them not to believe because she has, but to come and see for themselves and see what happens. That's the kind of witness she becomes. A blog that I was reading this week describes some of the ways I felt about this story. Something that attracts me to this story is that there's no healing, just good conversation. We're so used to the soundbite Jesus that it's interesting to see the person behind the Messiah. It's refreshing to think of Jesus sitting beside a 1,200-year-old well that was made famous by someone else. This story is divinity and humanity holding hands, laughing back and forth, and even getting a bit testy when the comments hit too close to home. But it's a conversation held in what becomes mutual respect. You might say a heavenly conversation, a holy conversation. Thomas More says, "Heaven is not some impossible, idealized world. It is ordinary life made brilliant by a philosophy of mutual respect." So what if we could move in some more of our relationships beyond the surface of them to see someone else for who they are, to be seen, to know someone and be known, and in that journey to love and to be loved? What if we're actually kind of like that Samaritan woman? What if we've been going back to the well every day, longing for water to quench our thirst? And every once in a while, there's a stranger who comes up and throws us off guard. And in doing that, invites us to a new way of life. What if, like the Samaritan woman, we could sit with Jesus at that well and have a conversation back and forth to learn, to know, to see and be seen, to fall in love in that process? See, the woman then takes on the role of the apostle, and she goes back to her own people and invites them to see as well. What if we sat at that well, were transformed, and then could share in our own ways with folks around us? Linda Taylor writes, and I'll close with her words, "In this season of Lent, we're called to look through the barriers we build to keep the holy in each other at arm's length, to look through the walls we build of daily life and thought and habit, to see the oneness that holds us. And like the woman at the well, we're called to dare immersion in the limitless sea of that unity. We're called to dare to lose the lives we know to gain the life God has prepared for us to live, to dare to speak the truth of our separation and of our unity, to dare to muster the courage to trust divine goodness, to dare to drink deeply of the water of everlasting life. May we walk with our hands waving and our smiles wide, that we might see and be seen, know and know others, be known by them, and in that process, to love a God who walks with us. Amen."